O'Neill, having interviewed Tesla on the subject, stated that Tesla made a definite distinction between the inventor who refined pre-existing technology and the discoverer who created new principles. Tesla declared himself a discoverer and Edison an inventor, and he held the view that placing the two in the same category would completely destroy all sense of the relative value of the two accomplishments. Support for this interpretation can be found in a letter Tesla wrote to the Lighthouse Board in Washington from his Colorado Springs experimental station in 1899. The Navy had written to Tesla that they would prefer to give their impending wireless contract to an American rather than to Marconi. "Gentlemen," Tesla responded curtly, "much as I value your advances, I am compelled to say, in justice to myself, that I would never accept a preference on any ground, as I would be competing against some of those who are following in my path. Any pecuniary advantage which I might derive by availing myself of the privilege is a matter of the most absolute indifference to me." If no one else would recognize his genius, Tesla certainly did. He would not think twice about giving up mere cash when faced with the prospect of being compared, in this case, to Marconi. The following letter to Johnson, which the inventor took the time to rewrite in a careful hand, was penned just 4 days after the announcement and 4 days before Sweden's decision to give the award to the Braggs. "My dear Luca, thank you for your congratulations. To a man of your consuming ambition, such a distinction means much. In 1,000 years, there will be many thousand recipients of the Nobel Prize. But I have not less than 4 dozen of my creations identified with my name in technical literature. These are honors real and permanent, which are bestowed not by a few who are apt to err, but by the whole world, which seldom makes a mistake. And for any of these, I would give all the Nobel Prizes which will be distributed during the next 1,000 years. This passage was contained in its entirety in the Hunt and Draper text. However, they incorrectly concluded that this sober message was overshadowed by jubilation because of the announcement. Johnson also incorrectly understood the full implication of the letter because in March 1916 he refers to the award fully expecting Tesla to receive it. In the New York Times interview on the day following their announcement, Tesla stated that Edison was worthy of 12 Nobel Prizes. The various Tesla biographers assumed that this was a public statement congratulating Edison, when in fact it was a piquant snub to the Nobel Committee. Tesla was stating between the lines that the Nobel Committee recognized only small accomplishments rather than truly original conceptualizations. "A man puts in here, in my Tesla coil, a kind of gap, he gets a Nobel Prize for doing it. I cannot stop it." Thus Edison's many better mousetraps could all be honored, but none of them, in Tesla's opinion, concerned the creation of new principles. They were simply refinements of existing apparatus. Edison would probably have agreed with Tesla on this point, for most of his inventions were actually further developments of other people's work. However, Edison did have a number of original discoveries and creations. In his own opinion, his most important contribution was the phonograph, which certainly was the work of genius, even by Tesla's criteria, and deserving of a Nobel Prize. Furthermore, Edison's unparalleled success in bringing promising creations to fruition was exactly Tesla's failure, and that too was a gift placing Edison in a category all by himself. Quite possibly, a letter much like the one sent to Johnson or the Lighthouse Board could also have been wired to the Nobel Committee. If this hypothesis is correct, a prejudice would have persisted against Tesla and Edison, and this would explain the indefensible position of the Swedish Royal Academy in never honoring either of these two great scientists. Wizard swamped by debts. Inventor testifies he owes the Waldorf, hasn't a cent in bank. As 1915 was drawing to a close, Tesla began to find himself in deeper and deeper financial straits. Although an efficient water fountain, which he designed that year, was received favorably, his overhead was still too high. Expenses included outlays for the turbine work at the Edison station, his office space at the Woolworth building, salaries to his assistants and Mrs. Skerritt, his new secretary, past debts to such people as the Johnsons and George Scherf, maintenance costs for Wardenclyffe, legal expenses on wireless litigation, and his accommodations at the Waldorf Astoria. Some of the costs were deferred, particularly by the hotel, but Mr. Bolt's patience had reached its limit. Tesla's uncanny elusiveness and noble air had worn thin. Rumours began circulating of peculiar odours and cackling sounds emanating from the inventor's suite. The maids were complaining that there was an inordinate amount of pigeon excrement on the windowsills. Bolt sent Tesla a bill for the total rent due, nearly $19,000. Simultaneously, Tesla was hit with a suit for $935 for taxes still owed on Wardenclyffe. Tesla signed over the Wardenclyffe property to Bolt just as he was called into the state Supreme Court. Before Justice Finch, the inventor revealed that he possessed no real estate or stocks, and that his belongings, all told, were negligible. Under oath, Tesla revealed that he lived at the prestigious Waldorf mostly on credit, that his company had no assets but is receiving enough royalties on patents to pay expenses, and that most of his patents were sold or assigned to other companies. When asked if he owned an automobile or horses, the inventor responded no. "Well, haven't you got any jewelry?" "No jewelry. I abhor it." This embarrassing article was published for all to see in the world. Yet, as was his custom with any article about himself, the inventor had his secretary paste the mea culpa in the latest volume of press clippings. Looking much like a multi-volume encyclopedia, this text, along with his other records and correspondence, would provide for posterity an accurate account of the inventor's rich and complicated life. The inventor had chosen his words carefully when speaking under oath to the judge. As much as he loathed being in a debtor's position, he wanted the Morgans, Marconis, Franklin Roosevelts, and Woodrow Wilsons to know of his plight, for in the final analysis, this shame would be theirs as much as his. Even T.C. Martin had turned against him, writing petty letters to Elihu Thompson at this time, complaining of how Tesla chiseled money out of him for the opus he had created of the inventor's collected works a generation ago. Attempting to raise funds in a variety of ways, Tesla continued to try to market his speedometer, push to get monies from American firms for the bladeless turbines, and collect royalty payments from Lowenstein and Telefunken for the Tuckerton and Sayville plants. The elder statesman of invention also continued to write newspaper articles for The World and The Sun for ready cash, and he also moved to exploit other creations, such as his electrotherapeutic machines with Dr. Morell. Tesla wrote Scherf that he expected the medical market to be $3 to $4 million. The publication of his wretched state in the public forum and the transfer of Wardenclyffe to another party produced in Tesla a deep sense of anger and corresponding shame, for now the world had officially branded him a dud. If success is measured in a material way, it was clear that Tesla was the ultimate failure. On the exterior, the inventor kept up appearances, but this event would mark the turning point in his life. Now he began the slow but steady turning away from society. Simultaneously, he travelled to live in other states, in part to conduct business in a fresh atmosphere, and in part to remove himself from a hostile environment. He wrote a letter to Henry Ford in Detroit, hoping finally that the auto magnate would recognize the great advantages of his steam engine. "I can tell any day that Ford is going to contact me and take me out of all my worries," Tesla confidently predicted to Julius Chito, Coleman's son, who was now working for him. Sure enough, one fine morning a body of engineers from the Ford Motor Company presented themselves with the request of discussing with me an important project, Tesla revealed a few years later. "Didn't I tell you?" the prophet remarked triumphantly. "You are amazing, Mr. Tesla," Julius responded. "Everything is coming out just as you predicted." "As soon as these hard-headed men were seated," Tesla continued, "I, of course, immediately began to extol the wonderful features of my turbine, when the spokesman interrupted me and said, 'We know all about this, but we're on a special errand. We have formed a psychological society for the investigation of psychic phenomena, and we want you to join us in this undertaking.'" Flabbergasted, Tesla contained his indignation long enough to escort the wayward explorers to the street. A Meeting with a Princess. Suffering from an attack of the grippe throughout the first month of 1916, Tesla made the newspapers by posing for a portrait for the provocative painter Princess Vilna Lvov-Palely. Daughter of Baroness von Solendorf and married and divorced from Prince Lvov of Russia, Vilna had painted the portraits of such greats as Field Marshal von Moltke, Bismarck, the Baroness Rothschild, Andrew Carnegie, Thomas Edison, and Teddy Roosevelt. Reluctant at first to sit because of superstitious feelings of foreboding, Tesla soon acquiesced and found a comfortable chair among Her Highness's various pets, which included, at one time or another, two dogs, an Angora cat, a bear, lion cub, alligator, ibis, and two falcons. Recently kicked out of the plaza for unpaid bills totaling $12,000, perhaps the princess shared a good laugh with the Serbian nobleman, who himself was in a similar predicament. The painting was reproduced in Electrical Experimenter in 1919, and once again on the cover of Time for Tesla's 75th birthday in 1931. This time period also saw the arrival of Tesla's sister's son, Nicholas Tebeljevich, himself an inventor who wanted to work as Tesla's assistant. Apparently Tesla was unable to spend much time with his nephew. Feeling rebuked, Tebeljevich turned to the local Serbian community, where he found a willing professor, Mikhail Pupin, who took the lad under his wing and on a tour of the city. Tebeljevich endeared himself to the great professor, and they became friends. Tebeljevich would come to develop in the 1920s and 1930s the hypoid gear and several sophisticated improvements in steering for the automotive industry. Working with mathematical principles, this inventor designed an elegant way to lower the drive shaft, running from the motor to the rear axle, nearly a foot. This advance enabled running boards to be eliminated, thereby allowing the car to become more streamlined. Simultaneously, it earned Tebeljevich a tidy sum. Moving to Detroit in the late 1920s, Tebeljevich continued to correspond with Uncle Nicky, who also came to visit around the time of the Great Depression. In February, Tesla received a letter from ardent admirer John Jack O'Neill, who was now working as a news correspondent for a Long Island daily and about to transfer jobs to the Herald Tribune. The young man reminded him of their 1907 encounter in the subway and enclosed the following poem. To Nikola Tesla, as an infinitesimal tribute to the inventor's greatness. Most glorious man of all ages, thou wert born to forecast greater days, where the wonders thy magic presages shall alter our archaic ways. Your coils with their juice oscillating sent electrical surges through the earth, sent great energies reverberating from the center to the outermost girth. Is thy mind a power omnipresent that fathoms the depth of all space, that speaks to an adolescent the future triumphs of the race? Tesla sent the youngster a letter in return, thanking him heartily, although your opinion of me is immensely exaggerated. Enigmatically, he also suggested that O'Neill write a poem for J. Pierpont Morgan, one man today on whom the world is depending more than any other. Should O'Neill do this, it might be instrumental in putting him in possession of a check. Considering that Pierpont was dead, this was a rather peculiar recommendation. The Edison Medal. Were we to seize and to eliminate from our industrial world the results of Mr. Tesla's work, the wheels of industry would cease to turn. Our towns would be dark, our mills would be dead and idle. Yes, so far-reaching is this work that it has become the warp and woof of industry. B. A. Behrendt, 1917. To those with eyes for the truth, Tesla's state of crisis cut deep. One engineer in particular, Bernard A. Behrendt, the Swiss émigré who had refused to testify against him during the malevolent AC patent litigation days, felt the urgency to act. Clearly, it was Behrendt's goal to help restore the reputation of his spiritual benefactor. Having devoted a large measure of his life to refining Tesla's invention of the induction motor, Behrendt informed his mentor that he, Tesla, had been nominated to receive the Edison Medal. In fact, it had been Behrendt who had proposed the idea to the committee. Winners from the past had included Alexander Graham Bell, Elihu Thompson, and George Westinghouse. that Tesla would be nominated by an organization dwelling under the banner of Edison's name was shocking enough to the brooding Serb. Edison himself must have allowed the presentation to be made. It does not appear that Edison, having just turned 70, was plagued by the reciprocal feeling of animosity that Tesla exhibited. It is more likely that the thought of giving Tesla the medal brought a broad smirk to the Menlo Park wizard's visage. Tesla's first reaction was abhorrence, and he flatly rejected the offer. But Behrendt persisted. Here was an opportunity to recognize a worthy recipient alone for his singular contributions. "Who do you want remembered as the author of your power system?" Behrendt inquired. "Ferraris? Schallenberger? Stillwell or Steinmetz?" Tesla reluctantly capitulated. The presentation of the Edison Medal was made on May 18, 1917, just 2 months before Tesla found out by telephone that vandals had broken into his Wardenclyffe laboratory and wrecked equipment valued at $68,000, and that the tower was to be destroyed by dynamite. Many familiar faces dotted the crowd. The Johnsons and Miss Merrington attended, as did Charles Scott and Edward Dean Adams, the man most responsible for recommending Tesla for the Niagara Falls enterprise. The opening speech was delivered by A.E. Kennelly, former Edison crony who was now teaching at Harvard. Long a Tesla adversary, having been active in executing animals with AC current during the heated battle of the currents in the early 1890s, Kennelly spoke for 15 minutes. During this time, the good professor managed to not mention Tesla's name even once. "Many people," Professor Kennelly began, "suppose that the Edison Medal is presented by Mr. Edison, but that is a mistake. In fact, Tom Edison has been so busy during his life receiving medals that he has not time to dispense any." The speaker droned on, making Tesla more nervous with each obsequious sentence. "Every time a worthy recipient is honored with this medal, Thomas Edison is also honored. In fact," the Edison man continued, "we may look forward to a time, say 1,000 years hence, when, like this evening, the 1,007th recipient will receive the Edison Medal, and once again, Edison's achievements will be honored." As legend has it, Tesla disappeared from the room. Panic-stricken, Behrendt ran out of the building to look for him, while Charles Terry, a prominent executive from the Westinghouse Corporation, reviewed Tesla's great accomplishments. According to the story, Behrendt found the lonely inventor across the street by the library, feeding his precious pigeons. During Behrendt's introduction, he stated, perhaps to counter Kennelly's opening speech, "The name of Tesla runs no more risk of oblivion than does that of Faraday or Edison. What can a man desire more than this? It occurs to me to paraphrase Pope describing Newton. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, 'Let Tesla be,' and all was light." "Ladies and gentlemen," Tesla began, "I wish to thank you heartily for your kind appreciation. I am not deceiving myself in the fact, of which you must be aware, that the speakers have greatly magnified my modest achievements. Inspired with the hope and conviction that this is just a beginning, a forerunner of still greater accomplishments, I am determined to continue developing my plans and undertake new endeavors. I am deeply religious at heart, and give myself to the constant enjoyment of believing that the greatest mysteries of our being are still to be fathomed. Evidence to the contrary notwithstanding, death itself may not be the termination of the wonderful metamorphosis we witness. In this way, I manage to maintain an undisturbed peace of mind, to make myself proof against adversity, and to achieve contentment and happiness to a point of extracting some satisfaction even from the darker side of life, the trials and tribulations of existence." The electrical savant would go on to review much of his life, an anecdote from his childhood about a gander who almost pulled his umbilical cord out, his early meetings with Edison and work with Westinghouse, lectures in Europe, success at Niagara, and future plans in wireless. "I have fame and untold wealth more than this," the inventor concluded. "And yet, how many articles have been written in which I was declared to be an impractical, unsuccessful man, and how many poor, struggling writers have called me a visionary? Such is the folly and short-sightedness of the world. Tesla was aghast that Bolt had not protected Wardenclyffe adequately, for it was valued at a minimum of at least $150,000. Even though he had signed it over to the hotel, he had done so, according to his understanding, to honor his debt until his plans matured. As the property, when completed, would yield $20,000 to $30,000 a day, Tesla was simply flabbergasted that Bolt would move to destroy the place. Bolt, or the hotel management, saw Wardenclyffe now as theirs, free and clear, even though Tesla offered as proof a chattel mortgage on the machinery that the inventor had placed at his own expense. The hotel's insurance was only $5,000, whereas Tesla's coverage for the machinery was valued at $68,000. Why would Tesla independently seek to protect the property if he didn't still have an interest in it? Tesla saw the contract as a security pledge, but the paper he signed did not specify any such contingency. According to the hotel's lawyer, Frank Hutchins of Baldwin and Hutchins, it was a bill of sale with the deed duly recorded 2 years ago. We failed to see what interest you have, Hutchins callously concluded. Storming into their offices on Pine Street, Tesla demanded to find out firsthand what was to happen. You will have to ask Smiley Steel Company. They are the ones in charge of salvage operations. J.B. Smiley informed Tesla that indeed the tower was to be taken down, its parts sold to cover outstanding debts. A great wrong has been done, the inventor wrote in reply, but I am confident that justice will prevail.
Pay no attention to Tesla whatsoever, but proceed immediately with wrecking as contracted, Smiley told his wrecking crew after conferring with Hutchins.
Waldorf Astoria Hotel Company, July 12, 1917. Gentlemen, I have received reports which have completely dumbfounded me, all the more so as I am now doing important work for the government with a view of putting the plant to a special use of great moment. I trust that you will appreciate the seriousness of the situation and will see that the property is taken good care of and that all apparatus is carefully preserved. Very truly yours, N. Tesla. The wizard decided that the only way to save Wardenclyffe was to extol its virtues as a potential defensive weapon for the protection of the country. Capitalizing on the excellent Nobel Prize publicity, the inventor once again strained the reader's credulity with another startling vision.
Tesla's new device, like bolts of Thor. He seeks to patent wireless engine for destroying navies by pulling a lever. To shatter armies also. Nikola Tesla, the inventor, winner of the 1915 Nobel Physics Prize, has filed patent applications on the essential parts of a machine, the possibilities of which test a layman's imagination and promise a parallel to Thor's shooting thunderbolts from the sky to punish those who have angered the gods. Dr. Tesla insists there is nothing sensational about it.
It is perfectly practicable to transmit electrical energy without wires and produce destructive effects at a distance. I have already constructed a wireless transmitter which makes this possible.
10 miles or 1,000 miles, it will be all the same to the machine, the inventor says. Straight to the point, on land or on sea, it will be able to go with precision, delivering a blow that will paralyze or kill as it is desired. A man in a tower on Long Island could shield New York against ships or army by working a lever, if the inventor's anticipations become realizations.
Tesla would not draw up an official paper on the particle beam weapon or death ray for another 20 years, yet it is clear that he had conceived the machine by this time, probably creating prototypes as far back as 1896, when he was bombarding targets with Roentgen rays. In a serious plight, with nowhere else to turn, the inventor contacted Morgan once again to ask for assistance. This was his last chance to protect his wireless patents and save the tower. Words cannot express how much I have deplored the cruel necessity which compelled me to appeal to you again, the inventor explained. But it was to no avail. He still owed Jack $25,000 plus interest. The financier ignored the entreaty and quietly placed Tesla's account in a bad debt file. In February 1917, the United States broke off all relations with Germany and seized the wireless plant at Saville. 30 German employees of the German-owned station were suddenly forced to leave, and enlisted men of the American Navy have filled their places. Guards were placed around the plant as the High Command decided what to do with the remaining broadcasting stations lying along the coast. Articles began springing up like early crocus to announce the potential existence of yet another concealed wireless station able to supply information to German submarines regarding the movement of ships.
19 more taken as German spies. Dr. Carl George Frank, former head of Sable Wireless, among those detained.
On April 6, 1917, President Wilson issued a proclamation, seizing all radio stations. Enforcement of the order was delegated to Secretary Daniels. It is understood that all plants for which no place can be found in the Navy's wireless system, including amateur apparatus for which close search will be made, are to be put out of commission immediately. Clearly an overt decision had to be made about the fate of Wardenclyffe. Tesla's expertise was well known to Secretary Daniels and Assistant Secretary Franklin Roosevelt, as they were actively using the inventor's scientific legacy as ammunition against Marconi in the patent suit. Coupled with the inventor's astonishing proclamation that his tower could provide an electronic aegis against potential invasions, Wardenclyffe must have been placed in a special category. However, there were two glaring strikes against it. The first was that Tesla had already turned over the property to Mr. Bolt to cover his debt at the Waldorf. And the second was the transmitter's record of accomplishment, non-existent. What better indication of the folly of Tesla's dream could there be than the tower's own perpetual state of repose? To many, Wardenclyffe was merely a torpid monument to the bombastic prognostications of a not very original mind gone astray. From the point of view of the Navy, Tesla may have been the original inventor of the radio, but he was clearly not the one who made the apparatus work. A History of Navy Involvement. In 1899, the U.S. Navy, via Rear Admiral Francis J. Higginson, requested Tesla to place a system of wireless telegraphy upon light vessel number 66 on Nantucket Shoals, Massachusetts, which lies 60 miles south of Nantucket Island. Tesla was on his way to Colorado and was unable to comply. Moreover, the Navy did not want to pay for the equipment, but rather wanted Tesla to lay out the funds himself. Considering the great wealth of the country, Tesla feigned astonishment at the penurious position of John D. Long, Secretary of the Navy, via Commander Perry, who brazenly forwarded the financial disclaimer on U.S. Treasury Department stationery. Upon Tesla's return to New York in 1900, he wrote again of his interest in placing the equipment aboard their ships. Rear Admiral Higginson, chairman of the Lighthouse Board, wrote back that his committee would meet in October to discuss with Congress the estimates of cost. Higginson, who had visited Tesla in his lab in the late 1890s, wanted to help, but he'd been placed in the embarrassing position of withdrawing his offer of financial remuneration because of various levels of bureaucratic inanity. Tesla spent the time to go down to Washington to confer face-to-face with the High Command. Hobson also negotiated on his friend's behalf, but Tesla was essentially ignored and returned to New York empty-handed and disgusted with the way he was treated. From the point of view of the Navy, wireless telegraphy was an entirely new field, and they were unsure what to do. Furthermore, they may have been turned off by Tesla's haughty manner, particularly when it came to being compared to Marconi, which had always enraged Tesla. Keep in mind, however, that the Navy took over 10 years to recompense Hammond for his work on radio-guided missiles, and even then they almost didn't come through. Tesla was by no means the only one to get the runaround from the military, and Hammond had the best connections possible through his influential father. In 1902, the Office of Naval Intelligence called Commodore F.M. Barber, who had been in retirement in France, back to the States and put him in charge of the acquisition of wireless apparatus for testing. Although still taking a frugal position, the Navy came up with approximately $12,000 for the purchase of wireless sets from different European companies. Orders were placed with Schlabe Arco and Braun Siemens Halske of Germany and Popoff, Ducreté and Rochefort of France. Bids were also requested from DeForest, Fessenden and Tesla in America and Lodge Muirhead in England. Marconi was excluded because he arrogantly coveted an all-or-nothing deal.